You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
Welcome back to the podcast. In this episode, it's going to be the second part of the best of 2023. So this is the other five episodes from the most downloaded and indeed engaged with episodes from 23. So without further ado, we're going to crack on with the episode. It starts with Keir and Alec Wilding and their reflections on major incident management. It got fantastic engagement, both parts, part one and part two. And in part one, we look at what major incident management means to Alec and to Keir. We also look at the P1 patient and the survivability of the P1 patient through the casualty clearing station, and whether the casualty clearing station should be used for P1 plus patients. We also look at their reflections on some of the most difficult and challenging major incidents that they've been involved with, and some of the reflections from the Manchester bombing inquiry, and just what we learned from that inquiry and report. Please do enjoy.
I suppose my take-home points that I'll probably will talk a bit about later is that the importance of that first 20 minutes, your performance under extreme stress and fear as well, the importance of clinical leadership by senior clinicians, the importance of walking the scene, and also really about not all P1 patients are the same. And that some P1 patients are sicker than the others, and some are actively dying. I think I'll talk later about really perhaps that kind of approach to that patient group and how we identify them. And finally, we have to understand the disease process of the patients that we're seeing, and not just because it's a major incident change the way we care for them. And we should do really what we do day in, day out for them. Certainly in London, around penetrating trauma, we promote really on short on scene times to move into hospital. And we probably should have to try and remember that.
I think it's funny, we talk about major incidents and actually it's just a term, it's just this defined term. And there's been a lot of significant incidents in London and, you know, around the country as well that never get sort of, you know, they never quite tip that threshold into being a major incident. But can be really, really challenging. I think when we talk about this stuff, they kind of sometimes get overlooked. And I think what's good now is that, particularly in London, I think we're really good at ramping up early. And I know some of the stuff that seems to be more commonplace in practice now, things like people giving ethane reports to like an RTC, relatively simple RTC, would still give an ethane report and getting used to that reporting mechanism.
For me, I think one of the big reflections I took from my experience is around the need to actively the importance of reducing preventable death and accessing a certain cohort of patients that we know are critically ill and need rapid access to them and intervention to keep them alive, followed on by evacuating them quickly and progressing them through the scene to definitive care.
And that's the one thing from Manchester that really came out is that, you know, this there's this concept of decision inertia, wanting to wait for more information that may not even come before being able to make a decision. And I think, again, from my experience to talk to other people, there's that need for rapid decision making. And in an ideal world, it's commanders are going to be making that jointly and together, but it's also, I think, really important to accept that that's not always possible. And and often, if you can see something that needs doing and, you know, you're going to make that dynamic risk assessment yourself, then, you know, there's a job to do and we need to crack on. It's also unlikely that any other service is ever going to say that it's safe. I can't imagine a situation when the fire service, the police are going to turn up and be like, yeah, it's safe, you guys can go on in. It's just, you know, I think these are they're sort of almost false narratives that we want to have to reassure ourselves. But the reality is, you know, the buck's got to stop somewhere. And I think a lot of the time that's us, but it has to be dynamic. And that's not to say that people should go rushing into situations, but there's this, the concept of the what if track. And at Manchester, there was this concern around a second device, but there was no credible evidence of it at all. So I think it leads to needing to rely on gut instincts, but also to mitigate the what ifs And there's tools in place that commanders use, like Eric PD and this sort of stuff.
My experience, certainly, the one I talk to most is about London Bridge, really, and around being dispatched as the initial kind of response to what was a single patient in traumatic cardiac arrest on the bridge. And then very quickly finding myself in what at the time was really an evolving, still an ongoing terrorist attack. And finding yourself in a very unique situation so early that you hadn't prepared for, because your mindset has very much been on one patient. And suddenly finding yourself in feeling considerable fear and threat for your safety and your life as well, I think, certainly in the first 20 minutes of that job, with ongoing shooting by the police and not really being aware of who was actually shooting at the time. But then I think it's, you know, as working in London and working as APPs, you become quite used to working in complex and challenging environments that can often be fast changing and often aren't necessarily always what you think they're going to be when you arrive. And I think kind of talking about safety, I can really remember, you know, we know a lot of incidents are over quite quickly. We know London Bridge was over within 8 minutes. I think Westminster was over very quickly. And when we look at a lot of incidents around the world, generally they have a short time where they're actually, there's an active threat. And we know, like Manchester, when they looked at it, and they actually, if you turned to zoning by 2250, it was actually a cold zone. And I think for me, you know, kind of reading the scene, engaging situational awareness, and I think I was probably I can look at London Bridge and I think I can kind of like reflecting on it afterwards, you know, subconsciously using people as an indicator for active threat. And I can remember being there and being told constantly by the police that, you know, there's an active shooter coming down from the South Bank. But actually, that was people calling in 999 calls saying they could hear shooting and could hear shooting, but they were hearing shooting in London Bridge. Or they were finding IEDs, or there's a hostage situation, or there was an IED in the van. And I think the fog of war, like you say, Owen, you're never going to truly, truly know what the genuine kind of risk to safety is, as opposed to what might be perceived, because the fog of war, that's going to happen. There's so much information. It's so chaotic. And it's interesting. I think like we probably look at a lot of those incidents around what happened in 2017 and we talk about safety, which is critical. And, you know, it's really important. We have a duty of care to our staff and we have a duty of care to patients. But how many members of staff were actually injured? And we talk about, you know, kind of threats from an active shooter or from a secondary device. But really, probably what do we think about is that potentially some of probably what the current evidence shows is that, you know, the real probable some of the safety risks where they lie are more conventional scene hazards. So things like contaminating dust, you know, kind of collapsing structures, secondary contamination at chemical incidents. And probably for me, the really big one is the impact of mental health on people post these incidents. And that's probably something that we don't talk about as often as we probably should be. But yeah, that's probably my experience and take on it.
Next up was Jason Killins on the future state of pre-hospital care. And so Jason gave a fantastic commentary on where we are right now within pre-hospital care, both from a triage treatment and indeed a see and treat, hear and treat, and a triage perspective. So Jason was and is the CEO of the Welsh Ambulance Service, and he just gave his reflection in a fantastic commentary on where he perceives pre-hospital care going. As he says within the episode, there's no secret that a lot of pre-hospital care that we see today is urgent care, and how we deal with that at source. So from point of call is really important. Do we continue with a fit model from the last 50 years, or do we fundamentally change the way we look and at these cores and triage these cores? So he gives some fantastic recollections, some fantastic commentary, and also a really honest and transparent view on how he sees the future of pre-hospital care. It's a fantastic episode. It got amazing engagement both on the podcast channels but also through social media channels as well, so please do enjoy.
You know, over the last, you know, you and I have seen this, you know, and many people listening to this podcast that work in the sector, both here in the UK and internationally, will recognize this picture, which is that over the last 10, 20, 30 years, the way our communities use their emergency ambulance services has shifted significantly. The expectation of immediacy in terms of, you know, provision of response, not just for the really sick patients that we go to, but all the other stuff as well. There's been changes, obviously, in how people can access, you know, care in communities. Primary care is difficult to access, as we all know. So the way our services have used have changed. Our populations have got older, generally speaking, you know, sweeping generalisation, but generally our populations, the communities we're serving, are older. Accessing primary care has got harder, and we've got more work because we've got a growing population. So activity is increasing year on year. And there are also shifts in the type of activity or the acuity of activity we're seeing. Now I would say, somewhat controversially perhaps, that the current model of ambulance service delivery, certainly here in the UK, which is largely, sweeping generalisation again, largely we get a 999 call, we listen to what's going on, we decide how important it is, and we go to scene. That's largely what we do. Yeah, that's been happening for 50 years. And I would say that the current model of service delivery is unsustainable. It's not affordable, it's unsustainable. It creates risk. I mean, we'll probably come on to kind of managing risk in the conversation, but in trying to service everything quickly, you know, we create risk in itself, clinical risk. So I think for a range of reasons, those that I've just kind of, I guess, articulated, and the state of the urgent and emergency care system, certainly here in the UK, particularly where we've got, you know, regions with extensive emergency department handover delays, which, you know, generate that additional pressure and community delay, where there is significant avoidable harm and clinical risk, let alone all the issues it creates for our people. In that environment, I would say, and we certainly would say here in the service in Wales, that we have to dramatically change, you know, truly transform the way we deliver care to our communities. And whilst, you know, we've fiddled around the edges with hear and treat, see and treat, see, treat and convey, consult and close, whatever you want to call it, those are relatively small numbers in the scheme of the total activity we see. So our vision, you know, for the next 3 to 5 years here, is essentially to flip the service model on its head. Now, you know, again, these are, you know, sweeping kind of numbers, if you like, but they just share these numbers to kind of, I guess, try and articulate the scale of the challenge. If you said that currently we respond to about 80% of the work we get, roughly, yeah, that will vary across services. It will vary within services by region. But if you just said roughly we go to 80% of the work we get, our view is that in the future, we would only go to 20% of it, you know, straight away. So we'd go quickly, and we, you know, we guarantee a quick response to all of the work, which we all know needs a quick response: cardiac arrest, chest pain, stroke, cardiac chest pains, not all chest pains, cardiac chest pain, strokes, car crashes, all that stuff. You know, we would go to and go to quickly in that 20% bucket. Everything else, our view is that we would not turn a wheel We would not seek to respond until it's at an upstream clinical assessment. That's not just by paramedics in our contact centres. That would be nurses. It might be, and some services are doing this already, mental health specialists. You might have pharmacists in there, a whole range of kind of clinicians, a multidisciplinary team, either employed by the ambulance service or that we access through arrangements with other providers, other health providers. And then only if we can't close that episode of care safely upstream with a clinical assessment, either on the phone or increasingly with video, you know, with a video consultation, if we can't safely close or refer that episode of care somewhere else, would we then go to scene? And if we did need to go to scene and it wasn't in that 20%, you know, in that really sick bucket, it would be with an advanced practitioner where we'd seek to close the episode of care in the community. Because I just don't think it's sustainable to continue to respond with a double-staffed, you know, emergency ambulance to all of the activity we've got. So, yeah, we've got quite, I guess you some might say, radical view about the future. But what's clear is the current model just cannot continue. It's not safe to carry on with what we've got as an approach. Our colleagues across emergency ambulance services or EMS services, you know, not just in the UK, but internationally too, are going to an increasing amount of, you know, social primary care complex, you know, long-term conditions, not stuff that would be traditionally in the emergency ambulance space. And of course, as the skills, education, and knowledge of our workforce has changed over time, you know, who'd have thought 10 years ago we'd have paramedics prescribing, you know? It's a really good example. Who'd have thought 10 years ago that we'd have had paramedics out there with FP10 pads, you know, writing out prescriptions? But we do, you know, we were the first here in the UK to put them on the streets, but, you know, lots of services have got them now. So with those kind of changes, not only in our workforce and the stuff we can do, but also in our connection to the rest of the health system. So for argument's sake, 10 years ago, we wouldn't have been able to see a GP patient record. Well, we can now, you know, and accrue, you know, a clinician in a clinical contact center upstream can look into a patient's, you know, GP record and see a whole bunch of stuff to inform their judgment that we just couldn't see 5 or 10 years ago. So with those advancements in the, you know, those changes that are available to us, we're able to do different stuff and manage, treat, respond, however, whatever you want to call it, differently to cohorts of work which traditionally we'd have had to go to scene for. So there is quite a lot of scope, we think, in our overall bucket of activity, which enables us to you know, differentiate that based on the evidence, based on clinical evidence, not just the MPDS determinant or the pathways equivalent, you know, but what we actually see when we get on scene. And of course, now with most services having an electronic patient record, we're able to interrogate that data much more rigorously than we were when we were all on paper with, you know, PRFs. I'll show my age now, or LA4s as it was when I joined, you know, a single A4 bit of paper. You know, we've got much better intelligence now, so we can use that information, use that intelligence to redefine how we safely respond to patients. It makes sense. Yes, you know, so there's a load of stuff which is very different now to 10 years ago, which enables us to have a very different approach to the work we do.
Next up was a conversation I had with Tim Edwards, who is a paramedic consultant for London Ambulance Service, and we spoke about pre-hospital sedation of the ABD, so the acute behavioural disturbance patient. This got some fantastic engagement and downloads on the podcast, and it was a really wide-ranging and encompassing conversation, just talking about a recent study which the advanced paramedic practitioners in critical care had performed on a number of ABD patients, just looking at the utility of sedation. We're also looking at the frequency of sedation and who is around when sedation occurs. It was again, extremely well engaged with episode. It was wide ranging for a number of reasons, but we also dissect what some of the fundamental issues with ABD, so acute behavioural disturbance patients, are, that of drugs and alcohol, and also just look at the spectrum of both treatment, but also the spectrum of presentations. So please do enjoy.
Yeah, so I think it's important to consider that acute behavioural disturbance is probably at the extreme end of the range of altered behaviour that we might see as paramedics. So I think one of the big challenges to start with acute behavioural disturbance is often that there are friends and family present, and there are other agencies, often the police and potentially door staff or security staff. And also that very often those patients will be subject to a degree of physical restraint, and that obviously poses risks as well. And then there are risks to paramedics with those patients who may be very dissociated. There's a risk potentially of physical injury, and often there are competing priorities. So law enforcement agencies may have different priorities to family members, who may have different priorities to paramedics. And so navigating your way through that is very challenging from an ambulance service or EMS perspective.
Could you maybe speak to sort of what this indicates and reflects regarding the use and efficacy of other sort of de-escalation techniques, maybe more simple de-escalation techniques?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the important thing is that obviously those techniques are within the scope of practice and capabilities of all paramedics, or not just paramedics, but all EMS responders, and they're really important techniques. So I think there's some patients for whom just a period of watchful waiting means that their behavior calms and they don't need any intervention. And sometimes you might see that in patients who are post-ictal, for example, as you know. And actually sometimes you might attend the scene as a specialist practitioner and find that a patient has calmed, and actually the initial request for assistance was perfectly reasonable, but just by watchful waiting, the behavior has changed to a point where sedation isn't required. There's then a group of patients who are being subject to physical restraint. And very often, particularly in a law enforcement setting, there may have been a struggle. There may have been a struggle to get the patient under control. There may have been a physical altercation. And actually, once that has calmed, if you can reduce a bit of restraint, if you can calm the scene, the patient's behavior will de-escalate to a level where chemical sedation isn't required. And then there's a set of patients for whom sedation probably is the safest and appropriate method of managing them. But as you can see from the study results, certainly in our system, that's by no means all the patients that we would see who are labelled as ABD. There's variation internationally in practice. And in the UK, we've traditionally been very wary of sedation and conscious sedation. So benzodiazepines, for example, are only used by UK paramedics predominantly for management of seizures and some limited indications around cocaine toxicity, but sedation is not a standard skill for a UK paramedic. I think the first thing to say about ABD patients is that circulatory collapse is a real risk, and a sudden deterioration is a real risk. And sometimes people can interpret a patient becoming less responsive or quieter as an improvement in their condition, whereas actually that may be a pre-terminal sign. It indicates complete physiological exhaustion. So whenever you're treating an ABD patient, whether you're sedating them or not, you need to be aware that circulatory collapse can be a complication. I think you need to pay meticulous attention to basic airway management. So it's not unusual for a patient to need some basic airway management maneuvers if they undergo rapid tranquilization. We tend to use ketamine for that reason, because it's fairly safe as an agent in terms of airway management, but no sedation agent is 100% safe. Then there's the potential risks of aspiration. And so the requirement to have basic airway adjuncts, advanced airway adjuncts, and a means of suction is really, really important, and a means of ventilating the patient, obviously, if they need it. So that's a rare complication in our system, but it does happen occasionally. And then, of course, as we said, circulatory collapse is a real possibility in a small subset of these patients. And so having equipment for resuscitation available is also really, really important. And assigning, as far as you can, specific team roles before you start that process is important as well. So an airway paramedic, paramedic or other clinician to put monitoring on, those kinds of things, so that once you make the decision to give the drug, you can look after the patient promptly once sedation takes effect.
Next up was part three of the addiction series I did on drugs and alcohol. Part one was Mark Dempster, who is an addiction specialist. Part two was a paramedic practice leader looking at addiction from a Canadian perspective. And part three was a consultant psychiatrist, Dr. Brian Hall, looking at addiction from his perspectives, both the addiction of and the psychiatry of addiction and also the psychology of addiction as well. This got fantastic engagement across the podcast platform. It also got quite a lot of feedback in a really good way from a number of you, just looking at addiction and just how indeed paramedics perceive and also just the problem of addiction from a pre-hospital perspective, how frequently it occurs and how much time and energy it takes up from an NHS perspective as well. Please do enjoy. Brian is a fantastic guest, has got a really unique perspective and insight on addiction services, and I found it very informative as a conversation.
The substance or the behavior becomes important to the person who's becoming dependent. You get a salience of drink-seeking behavior. People protect their supply. They make sure they've got enough money to last the weekend because they know they're going to want to drink on Sunday. And it's to do with the other thing he found with alcohol was a thing that no one else has ever bothered with in any of these definitions, which is called the narrowing of the repertoire. So as we grow up, we drink in weddings, pubs, funerals, all over the place, lots of different environments. As we become more dependent, that repertoire narrows down to a point where I had a patient who would drink in a lavatory. He would keep a bottle in the cold cistern of the toilet. He would come in, take it out, put a warm one in, and he would sit in the toilet and drink in the toilet and couldn't understand why people were outside going to pubs and parties when they could do what he was doing, which is lock himself in a toilet. I would suggest that's a narrow drinking repertoire. And people who are becoming dependent, they stay in, leave the curtains drawn. And so some of these features are amazing. Most of the drugs that we talk about, including alcohol and particularly opioids, people get a tolerance to them. So you start off as a 13-year-old kid drinking and you get a bit sloshed after a pint of beer. By the time you get to 18, you need three pints to get the same amount. But it does take a long time with alcohol. You don't get a tolerance. Whereas with other drugs like opioids, you can get a tolerance very quickly. Within 6 weeks, you start off with a few, you know, 10-pound bag of heroin. And within 6 weeks, you're actually taking a lot more. You know, your tolerance with opioids goes up very rapidly. So it's the drug becomes important. You sometimes get a narrowing of the repertoire. You get a tolerance. And with most drugs, although not so much with the stimulants, you start to get withdrawal symptoms. And withdrawal varies from drug to drug. So with alcohol, it's tremor, it's nausea, vomiting, altered mood states, retching. With other drugs, it varies. There's not much of a withdrawal syndrome with stimulants like cocaine, but it happens at a cellular level. And the way it manifests is with craving. So somebody comes into rehab with taking 4 grams of cocaine, they have a detox, they get into the program. But the way they don't have the shakes, they don't have sweats, that sort of thing, which you do with opioids, which you do with alcohol. But what you get with high doses of cocaine and other stimulants, it happens at a cellular level. And about day number 5, you get an intense craving and the person leaves treatment, goes out and goes to their dealer. And nobody could really understand it until they understood that actually withdrawal with stimulants happens at a cellular level in the brain. And so with withdrawal with alcohol, people then start to drink in order, not because they like the taste of a wine or whatever, but because they want to relieve the withdrawal symptoms. So you drink to relieve the withdrawal symptoms. And then as you progress into dependence, you start to get a compulsion to drink. You know, we've all had a compulsion. I am going to have that cream bun. Nothing's going to stop me. And that's what happens as we become dependent. We get a compulsion to drink or to use the drug. And that happens pretty quickly, depending on the drug and the route of administration, which is another important factor. It depends how you take these drugs. Quickest way to get addicted is to inhale them, whether you're smoking nicotine, whether you're smoking heroin. It's the quickest way to get it to the brain is actually to inhale it. A lot of people think it's to inject it. It's not. It's inhaling it, whether you're smoking it or inhaling it like an anesthetic. So what an anesthetist will do is he'll put us to sleep with an injection. You get a big dose of drug hitting the brain, and then he'll switch over to something that you inhale in and out because it's much more sensitive and you can control it better. And then the other thing that is kind of controversial, but it's very useful, is what Edwards described as the reinstatement of dependent drinking after a period of abstinence. Now, what that means is if you're in jail or it's Lent or it's Ramadan or whatever, if you're not drinking, and you are dependent, if you start drinking again, you reinstate into dependent drinking with the craving, with the withdrawal, with the relief drinking, with the compulsion. And the more severely dependent you are, the more rapidly you reinstate. Now, that's kind of a hallmark of addictive disorders, because this whole question of, you know, can people control their drinking? Can they control their opioid use? It depends on the drug. It depends on the half-life of the drug. But the answer with alcohol is once they've become dependent, and there's a load of research now that supports it, it's very difficult to control your drinking. A lot of studies have claimed that these people had CBT or psychological treatments and they could now control their drinking. But when people went back and looked at those cohorts, the most famous of which was done by a group called the Sobels, and they said, yeah, all our people, they've returned to normal drinking. But when actually some abstinence fanatics went and looked at that cohort, they found that they were drunk, they were getting arrested, they were jumping off bridges. They were reinstating into dependent drinking. Now, that's a rather long-winded answer to your question, a working definition. I think that generally speaking, a good definition of addictive disorder is it's a chronic relapsing disorder characterized by compulsive use, compulsive drug seeking and use, despite adverse consequences. So that's the number of different definitions all rolled up together, and it's quite succinct. I'll repeat it. It's a chronic relapsing disorder. I'm not saying it's a disease or anything like that. Chronic relapsing disorder characterized by compulsive drug seeking and use despite adverse consequences. And that kind of summarizes the whole thing rather well. And instead of drug seeking, it might be a behavior, it might be a process addiction, like shopping when you can't afford it or whatever. The other thing that happens is people will cross addict. So they'll give up their drug of choice, like alcohol or cocaine, but then they'll get into shopping or sexually acting out or doing things basically that provide instant gratification. And that's probably the hallmark of things that are addictive. They give us instant gratification. You go down to Selfridges, spend 300 quid on a sweater you can't afford, and you kind of like it, you get excited, but then you go outside and feel bad because actually you've been very irresponsible and how are you going to pay the rent, for example. So the trouble with a lot of this kind of conversation is that people will cross addict. So particularly, I don't want to say particularly women, but let's say women who've had a cocaine problem go into rehab and they start to, they become abstinent from cocaine, but then they'll start to eat and then they put on weight and they can't bear it. And so they relapse. This happens quite a lot, cross addiction, or people will move from one addictive disorder into the other. So a number of people, if you talk to people who've been dependent on alcohol and they stop, they love the buzz of watching their horse come in first in the 4:30 at Newmarket or whatever. They'll move into gambling, or they'll go online casinos, or they'll do things that actually give instant gratification when you win, but they cause misery when you stop winning. So I know a guy who goes to Rome, has Armani suits made, doesn't bother to wear them, he just likes it, and then feels bad and gives them away to charity shops, doesn't even wear them. And it's a compulsive behavior that, so there are what we call process addictions, which would include things like shopping and sexual acting out and exercise, eating, things that are to do with instant gratification. And sometimes that can be the primary problem, but more often than not, it's secondary. In my clinical experience, it's been secondary to an addictive disorder that's involved alcohol or drugs. And I'm not including nicotine in that, although nicotine is obviously, it's probably the hardest drug to kick, actually. Talk to any heroin addict who's given up smoking, they'll tell you smoking was harder.
The final conversation in the series, and indeed of 2023, which got amazing engagement across the podcast, from a download profile, but also online as well from the social media, was the conversation with Liz Thayer on paramedic burnout. Again, as you hear from the episode, I really wanted to have this conversation for a while because I think it doesn't get enough airtime and is probably more endemic than we choose to understand, know, or indeed acknowledge. So Liz brought a fantastic perspective to this conversation. She also has done her own primary research on this issue, and she spoke to that as well within the conversation. I learned a lot from her perspectives, certainly on her perspectives around resilience, the different models, and the different empirical research which exists within the space. So please do enjoy this final conversation of 2023 with Liz Thayer.
I think if you talk to any paramedics at the moment, they will explain to you how the workload has just gone up exponentially over the last few years. And as concerning as that is, I think what's really concerning is that it's also starting to come through from the students. So our future paramedic workforce are also starting to question maybe their career choices and consider whether or not that's something they want to go into. And so some of the problems around it are way beyond our control. We all had a pandemic, it was horrendous, and it did horrible things to the health workforce generally. But there are other things that are positive and also contributing to this. So people are living longer, which is lovely, but they tend to live at home with comorbidities, and that means that paramedics need to come to them. And so with less other health services, they might be involved in that a little bit more. But I think there are things that we can do maybe to help alleviate some of the stresses around this. And some of those relate to that paramedicine career. In the past, maybe when I started training, paramedics were all about you just come in, you work for a jurisdictional ambulance service, and you don't have any other opportunities. And now lots of professional organisations all around the world are starting to open up different career paths, consider things that maybe aren't full-time work, consider things that maybe aren't shift work. And so they're the kinds of things that we need to balance and explore, given that we're really struggling with those prevailing increasing workload problems that we have. So burnout is one of those terms that we tend to throw around a lot. It just makes it into normal conversation, and it's getting towards the end of the week or the end of the year and people are saying, oh, I feel really burnt out. And I think what they're often talking about in that setting is they're saying they're really fatigued or they're really tired. And it's important to realise that burnout goes beyond just that tiredness. That's terrible, but it's much more than that. And so what I really like to think about is burnout as a syndrome, because I think from a healthcare perspective, that always gives us a red flag that there's lots of things at play. So as a bit of a working definition, burnout is a feeling of being physically, emotionally, and mentally drained. And that's due to stressors at work, so stress within your work environment, and that results in the fact that you can't meet the demands of your job. And so those three parts interplaying together, pretty much what we're talking about when we talk about burnout. I think the other thing is that paramedics are very good at presenting a front to the world, Anyone who does shift work and has to look positive and upbeat at 3 o'clock in the morning learns very quickly how to present a front. And so sometimes it might not be as easy to identify some of those issues. And this is why there is such a big debate going on about, is burnout a mental health disorder or in its own right, or is it the predecessor to a mental health disorder, or is it the subsequent outcome of a mental health disorder? So there's definitely links there to depression, to anxiety, but it's much more complex than just that nice linear path that maybe we described it as. So I did a study of Australian paramedics, and there's a number of tools you can ask people to complete to check burnout. And we used one called the Copenhagen Burnout Inventory, or CBI. And that looks at personal burnout, which is sort of an overall kind of thing, work burnout, how it attributes to work, and patient burnout, which I thought was really interesting. And we surveyed about 1,000 paramedics in Australia. 56 of them were found to be experiencing burnout, which is probably the first concern. But less so about risk factors. We don't look at risk factors because that tends to be predictive, but we looked at predictors. So looking backwards, what predicted those people to be in burnout? And we found three of them. The first was being female. The second was working in capital cities. In Australia, we have large capital cities, but then we go all the way down to rural and remote, where you're traveling huge distances, understandably. And the last was having been a paramedic for between 15 and 19 years. So being female, it's very mixed in the literature as to whether or not that actually is. A lot of the literature says that females simply express themselves better and therefore maybe articulating that. The other concerns with the female cohort are that they often take on a lot more caring responsibilities outside of the workplace. And so when we think of all of those job demands coming in, there might be more of them there. The other big thing with paramedic research in this area is that lots of it has really skewed data. So there's lots of research going on where the number of females being surveyed is quite small. We had about a 50-50 split in our study. The idea of working in a capital city seems to increase burnout by about 3 times. And we were sort of split in deciding whether or not we were expecting this. Work in a big capital city, lots more work, lots more people there, continuation of work. But you also have a lot more resources. So again, it's nice. You come back to that job demand resource model and you can see how having the resources does actually mitigate. So if you've got the good resources there, you've got support from your organisation. And then the last one was being there for 15 to 19 years. And this was quite different to what often people talk about, oh, people burn out within 7 years or a lot earlier on. So we weren't necessarily expecting this as a predictor. But if you think about it, if you start your career at about 18 or 20 or something like that, 15 to 19 years tends to be when life is happening. When you're juggling a family, young family, partner, mortgages, rents, all of those kinds of things. And so maybe it's more about all of those other demands that's happening outside. And so you suddenly see how complex burnout can be, and especially when we want to interact or make some idea of addressing burnout for people. So I'll start off by saying resilience is a good thing. Everyone should be resilient, and anyone who is a paramedic, knows a paramedic, has lived with a paramedic, knows that paramedics are resilient. There is absolutely no way you could be a paramedic without being resilient. Resilience, if we define it, it's about adapting to adversity. And so that's something that is bread and butter for most paramedics. It's about juggling work and shifts and unpredictability. So it's useful and it's something that we have. My concern comes that resilience has been presented previously, and it's a bit less so now, but it's previously been presented as this panacea, the one-stop shop will fix burnout, just need to fix their resilience. And it, for something that's so multifaceted as burnout is, it seems unlikely that a single aspect will fix it. And that is the case. And so if we think back to that lovely job demand resource model, resilience is going to help with the personal resources, so the relationships, maybe the teamwork, the social aspect, but it's not going to have any impact on the job demands, on the time pressures, the understaffing, the lack of equipment, all of those kinds of things. And from an organisational perspective, the nice thing is that if they put effort into that, it impacts your entire workforce. But we can't put it all on individuals. And the last thing is that I always feel very uncomfortable saying that someone who is maybe experiencing those early stages of burnout, ascribing blame to them by saying, you're not resilient enough. There are too many factors at play here.
Okay, so that's it for 2023. Thank you so much for being involved in the journey with me across the year. I've had some fantastic conversations, more to come in 2024. Indeed, I believe this episode is going to be the first week of 2024. We've got lots of fantastic guests lined up. And what I want to do as well within the podcast is really get more voices involved within the podcast. So more paramedics, doctors, nurses speaking as hosts, not just as guests. So my idea is to sort of democratize the platform out to other healthcare professionals so they can also bring you their perspectives as well. But thank you for your engagement across 23. Please do feedback, rate and review, and indeed subscribe to the podcast. It'd be great to get more engagement within 24 and just magnify more voices across the podcast, and indeed learn as we go. Many thanks again, and I'll speak to you soon.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care podcast on the Medics Academy Network.